New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
It may be shocking to realize that indeed the Buddha himself was a social revolutionary. He cast aside the rigid social order of the elite society in which he was born and dispensed with all the rites and rituals of worship that were so prevalent at that time. He went on to create a community of honesty and simplicity and a congregation with no rank or caste. All were equal in the eyes of the awakened mind. He left us with a map of how to effectively live our lives with skillful means. Today, we'll be exploring that map with award-winning actor and Zen priest, Peter Coyote. Peter Coyote is a master of many crafts, including being an award-winning actor, improv teacher, author, director, screenwriter, a narrator who has worked with some of the world's most distinguished filmmakers, including Ken Burns. He's won several Emmys for his narration and was ordained as a Zen priest in 2011. In 2015, he received transmission from his teacher, making him an independent Zen teacher. He's the author of many books, including Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is. Join us for the next hour as we explore the fundamental teachings of the Buddha as they apply to contemporary daily life with our guest, Peter Coyote. I'm speaking with Peter in his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Peter, welcome.
Well, thanks, Justine. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. I would like to go back to some of the beginnings that led you to Buddhism. In your early life as a Buddhist, you were really practicing in a Buddhist monastic setting. And then that trajectory led you to something that you call nothing special Zen moment. So it would be helpful to know about that trajectory and where your commitment as a Zen Buddhist priest is now.
Sure. Well, really the first time I ever heard of Buddha or Buddhism was reading the Beat Writers back in the late 1950s. We had come through a tough political time. There were a lot of socialists and even communists in my family who were really broken and ruined by the McCarthy period. And these were people who were school teachers, professors, labor organizers. They were not spies for Stalin. And when they figured out what Stalin was up to, they left the Communist Party. But, you know, they were young men and women, and they were trying to do right. And the government was so egregious about lying about them, I was shattered by it. I mean, it took me, I'd say, 30 years before I could salute the flag. And I watched grown-ups broken and in tears in my living room, actors and all sorts of people who couldn't continue their work. Norman Thomas, the candidate for vice president, wound up grooming poodles to make a living. So by the time I discovered the Beats, who were adults and who were critical of this system and gave me language and perspective and ideas, I also encountered them talking about Buddhism. And sort of first among them, the most seemed like the most knowledgeable was Gary Snyder. And my good luck was such that, I don't know, 20 years later, well, not 20, let me see, I was about 14 and 15. Yeah, so maybe 10 years later, I was in San Francisco. I dropped out of school, and I was deep in the bowels of the counterculture. And I actually was introduced to Gary by Lou Welch, one of the Beat poets and one of his friends. And he was just really impressive, and I couldn't sway him with my passionate recitals of how revolutionary and important I was. He just kept looking at me like, who is this guy? And something about the way he looked at me was very disturbing. And I said, I'm going to get to know this guy. And because I grew up on a farm, I was pretty handy, chainsaws, working, manual stuff. So I started visiting up at his house in the Sierras. And his life was so ordered and calm and connected on so many levels, spiritual, political, family man, that I was flabbergasted. And I realized that this is what a Zen life could look like. He had lived 9 years in a Japanese monastery. Lou Welch told me that he received his teacher's bowl, which is a symbol of transmission. And then I was still deep in the counterculture. I was using a lot of drugs. My life was not very orderly, but Gary lit a candle in the dark. And by 1972, all my countercultural experiences had come to naught. Our children were growing older. The communes broke up. We didn't own the land. People had to move closer to schools. And I wound up as a single father with a young daughter. And my family, my dad had died way below broke. And so all of his promises that I never had to worry about money didn't materialize. And I knew that I had to change my life, that if I were to OD, my daughter would wind up in a state home. So I did that, and luckily I met and fell in love with a woman who was a serious Zen student. And the book is, the first dedication in the book is to her. And I started practicing at San Francisco Zen Center, which I hated. I had spent 10 years pursuing absolute freedom, living by whim. And here I was in this quiet, calm, orderly place. Nobody ever raised their voice. There were no passions. There was no wildness. And, you know, I just thought I was already enlightened and I just need to polish it up a little bit for the white people. And something happened. And in the 8 years I spent at Zen Center, I could say was the most radical period of transformation in my life. I settled into and discovered the usefulness of discipline, of sitting still, of detaching from my own mind, of not believing all my thoughts. And it put me on the path that I'm on today.
That's it.
So you, just to finish the second part of your question. So that was the start. But after 8 years at Zen Center, I began to be a little stressed by the Japanese gift wrapping, I call it. It would always appear foreign. And if our goal was to save all beings and to win over many Americans, I thought we should translate the Buddha's teaching into an American idiom. Because he wasn't Japanese. He was born in Nepal. And everywhere, and when he first started teaching, his teachings were wrapped in Hindu gift wrapping. And that's why all the talk about reincarnation and things like that. And in every country that Buddhism went to, it gift-wrapped itself in the idioms and mores of the culture, so they would not offend. And they were always at the prerogative of the king. But this is the first time in the West where Zen Buddhism is liberated from state or royal control. And we have the freedom to look at the Buddha's teachings and figure out how are they appropriate and what's the best way to teach them to our people.
So are you saying, let me just ask you, saying that even the Japanese flavor of gift-wrapped Buddhism was condoned by the state?
Well, that's absolutely true, but that doesn't invalidate it.
No.
And neither am I saying that I find any fault in monastic practice. But it seemed odd to me that we were all white people, that we were given Japanese names, that all the titles and roles of occupations in the Zen Center had Japanese names, which I could never keep straight. The Eno, the Doan, the Doshi. It sounded like a square dance call. So I just, when I left, I realized that my practice was going to be secular. And it was on me to figure out what a secular practice was going to look like. I revere my training. I revere much of the Japanese aesthetic. I have tatami mats in my little zendo. I sit on black cushions. I wear my robes proudly. But for the most part, most Buddhists in America are secular, and they're not going to live as monastics. So I wanted to find a way to talk to them and invite people to see even the states of mind as applicable to American culture. Things like, I've met a woman who lost herself in her knitting. She just disappeared. Well, that doesn't make her Kensho any less available or authentic than if she'd been wearing black robes. So I wanted to try to, without throwing away the gift wrapping, I wanted to try to loosen it and make it more accessible to Americans.
So you've been really living that, from what I understand, in the way that you actually write and live and the talks you give. And thank you for that whole background. That really helps to put the foundation of what we're talking about today. And that is, like, as I said in the beginning, Buddha was a revolutionary in some ways. And that there is something he gives us these maps of right living, of good living, of effective living, of skillful living. And that includes goodness for all beings, yes. In other words. And there's something in one of the maps he gave us that many of us are familiar with, very, very familiar with, are the Four Noble Truths. And we mostly listen to them or see them written, and it's all about, life is suffering. So I would like to talk about that in just one moment, but I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Peter Coyote, and he is the author of Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is. And to find out more about his work, you can go to his website, where he has Dharma talks and activism projects on his website, as well as his writings. You go to petercoyote.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you.
I'm here with Peter Coyote, and we're talking about nothing special Zen Buddhism. And we're going to launch into the Four Noble Truths. And you help flesh that out in a very different way, which I deeply appreciated. So tell us about the first noble truth, suffering.
Sure. Well, I have to give credit to David Brazier, who is a Pure Land priest in London, or in England, rather, who wrote a wonderful book called The Feeling Buddha. And he was the first person that really translated the Four Noble Truths in a way that made complete sense to me. It was always a little vague to me. What's the relationship to say, you know, life is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end of suffering, there's a path to the end of suffering. But that doesn't give much away. So he went directly to what the Buddha said. And when the Buddha rose from, you know, he spent 49 days after his enlightenment just trying to figure out how to transmit what he'd learned. He was frightened that it would be too subtle or too complex or something for ordinary people. But he was moved to try, feeling he could help some people. So when he came back to the students that he'd been living with as ascetics in the jungle, they recognized his changes immediately. And the first lecture that he gave was the Four Noble Truths. And so the first one in Sanskrit was dukkha, D-U-K-H-A. And, you know, the word suffering is an English translation. It's done by Christians. It has Christian overtones to it. And I always had some struggle with it because it seemed to put the emphasis more on the mental aspect of suffering. Like, it's not the sickness that's suffering, it's worrying about the sickness that's suffering. Anyway, the Buddha himself told us what dukkha was, and he defined it as birth, death, grieving, pain, being stuck in a situation that you don't want to be in, being denied access to a situation that you do want to be in. He was very concrete about it. And from seeing that, you realize it's not saying that life is suffering. David translates it as affliction. So I think of it as all of us, all beings, everything, living in a peppered wind. We're under affliction, and it's kind of what keeps us going and moving and changing. Now, he called it noble truths, and it's the Buddha did, and it's worth parsing that a little bit. If truth means anything, it means real. Meaning it's not imaginary. Your suffering's not imaginary. You're not suffering because you're spiritually undeveloped. You're afflicted by things that are going on the earth. If you're too cold, you move closer to the fire. If you're too hot, you move away from the fire. And it's the way that the pot is stirred. Noble means either dignified or worthy of respect. So he's telling you that this affliction is not something to be fled. This is actually a primary part of the universe, a primary part of all existence, and you're not supposed to run away from it, and it's not your fault.
Say that again. It's part of life, and it's not your fault.
Yeah. Because many people feel, you know, I wouldn't be so upset if I was enlightened. That's not, right. It's nonsense. When you save someone from drowning, you don't drain the ocean. And so instead of saying, when they say Buddha was saved from all suffering, we could say saved from the effects of all suffering.
Effects.
Or saved from the effects of all affliction. So the second noble truth is samudaya. And what it means is arising. And it means when you're afflicted by something, somebody cuts you off in the car and scares you, anger arises or fear arises, or you want to flip them the bird. That too is not your fault. It's connected. Dukkha and samudaya are connected. The third noble truth is the first one that you can actually do something about, and that's called Nirodha. And the word Nirodha relates to a clay wall that's built around a fire pit that stopped flames in a peasant village from leaping over the wall into the fields or burning the houses. And for Buddha, the flames are the passions. So when we meditate and when we sit and when we put our attention on our posture and our breathing, we're sequestering a certain amount of our awareness so our mind can't run away with it. That means we have a little perch from which to study the mind and the body and what arises.
I think you give an analogy in your book. That energy, that flame, is like the gasoline. If we contain it in an automobile engine, it does
useful. Work. If you light it on the ground, nothing happens. So that's the third noble truth. And that's the one, that's the reason why we sit and meditate. We learn that we can withstand whatever arises. Because remember, it's the running away that gets us in trouble. When there's something that we can't face and we run away to drink or drugs or the wrong bed or shopping too much or whatever we do to compensate, neither is it dignified, and it always gets us in more trouble. So Buddha was trying to teach us how to live a dignified, noble life and have energy to help other people. So the fourth noble truth is called Marga, and this is the path. Once you've learned to control what comes up in you, you walk this path. And the path was the Eightfold Path. These were like little guideposts that were invented by the Buddha's enlightenment or discovered through the Buddha's enlightenment. I can never remember all of them, but right view, right energy, right conduct, right livelihood.
Speech, right.
Yeah, right, yeah. Speech. And so yeah. My teacher doesn't use the word right, because in English it connotes the opposite of wrong.
Wrong, exactly.
So we use the word Buddhist. So we say Buddhist speech, Buddhist livelihood, meaning this is the way we do it. So walking through your life, step by step, aware, checking yourself. Am I speaking kindly? Am I doing good here? Am I causing trouble? There's no Buddhist cops out there. This is, you are consulting your own Buddha nature. And your Buddha nature is the formless primal energy of the universe. That energy that is always transforming itself into forms, infinite myriad forms. But there's a substrate, which we call Buddha nature, which is the way that I conceive of it is, imagine standing on a cliff looking at a choppy ocean full of little peaky waves, not big rollers. Each of those little peaks could be a human life, could be an animal, could be a nameable thing in the universe, could be a culture, could be a mountain range, but they rise up out of the formlessness of the ocean, they assume shape for a while, and then they fall back in the ocean. So when they're in form, like a little peak, we say, oh, they're living. And when they go back to the ocean, we say, they're dead. But we're overlooking the fact that they've never not been part of the ocean. Not for an instant, just like we have never not been part of oxygen, sunlight, water, microbes in the soil growing our food, the people planting our cotton, kicking it, spinning it, sewing it into clothing. We're all like ticks on the body of a dog. So we have this self-awareness, which suggests that we're an independent entity. But that's only half the equation. The other half is that we are an extrusion of emptiness. We are unnameable. We are the universe itself. And once you understand that, And you understand that the thing you refer to as I and me and mine has no form, has no shape, has no color, has no location. It's just awareness. So nothing about you is cast in stone. If there are things about yourself that you don't like, you can change them because they're just habits. It's not like there's an armature inside you that is warped or bent somehow. So the implications of his teachings are very simple and very, very profound. And as one of the early Zen masters said, a child could understand them, and it takes a lifetime to put them into practice.
Ah, right. And that reminds me of one of the quotes that you use several times in your book from David Harris. And when you talk about acting out of habit, you're talking about there's a kind of ethical foundation to Buddhism and how our aspiration to act in an ethical way.
The David Harris quote was, values that are not expressed in action don't exist. And what he meant by that is, it doesn't matter what you think you're doing. It doesn't matter what you talk about at cocktail parties. If you're not walking this walk and putting it in your life, you're not doing it. So there's a wonderful story about this. I don't want to go on and on, but in the 13th century, there was a Zen master named Fuketsu. And Fuketsu was a disciple of Dogen, the great master that brought Zen from China to Japan. And he gave the following little lecture. If you pick up a speck of dust, the nation prospers. If you don't pick it up, nothing happens. So what he meant was, picking up the speck of dust can be doing anything. Next to the immensity of the universe, anything you do is a speck of dust. Building a new Zen temple, fighting for world peace, fighting for gay rights. Doesn't matter what, it's just a tiny speck of dust. But if you pick it up, if you're one of those people that can't just look at the world suffering and do nothing, you pick up the speck of dust. Now, there are some people that can look at the suffering and are not called upon to do anything. And those people don't pick up the speck of dust and nothing happens. But for those of us that pick up the speck of dust, the most important thing that Fuketsu teaches is that when you pick it up, you pick up the whole world. You don't pick up just the good you think you're doing. You'll do as much bad as you do good.
We need to talk more about that part of it, too. In just one moment, I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Peter Coyote. We're talking about Zen in the Vernacular, which is the title of his new book. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.